Hello, welcome to the Economia podcast. And with us today are Emma Jones, the founder of Enterprise Nation, and Bobby Lane, the partner at Shelley Stock Hutter. But we're at the Enterprise Nation pop-up at Quality Call. Emma, do you want to tell us a bit about what that is?
So, Richard, lovely to be here. We moved into the Enterprise Nation pop-up on Monday of this week, and what we have done is we've done a partnership with a property company called Club Workspace, because what we wanted to do is a business services pop-up to essentially say we have provided business support online for 8 years. Can we now provide that offline? So we're hosting 20 events over the next month, and people can come and co-work here as well. So it's a very busy environment, and it's great to see startups and small businesses meeting and literally working alongside each other.
So there's only Enterprise Nation members who are allowed in at the moment?
So anyone is allowed in to come to the events. So we've got free, all the events are free. So we've got power hour lunches, we've got an evening event tonight, which is all about how you convert more customers on your website. They're available for anyone to attend, but it's Enterprise Nation members who are coming in for the co-working.
Wow. Which ties in quite nicely with what we were going to talk about today, which is how you grow and evolve a business. So if we're looking at a life cycle of a business from concept to finish. And this is something you in particular have looked at, how a lot of people start a business around having another job.
Absolutely. So we call it Working 5-9. We published a book on it 4 years ago now. So as you say, that's the concept of people keeping hold of the day job, starting a business at nights and weekends. I still think it's a great way to start a business, because the whole idea is you're keeping the security of a salary, so you're giving yourself time to build cash flow, but also confidence in the business. Mm. And in fact, we hold the big event that we hold all year, every year, is called Startup Saturday. The reason why we hold it on a Saturday is we've got lots of 5-to-9ers, so they're working a day job during the week. And again, the same thing here with co-working is people are starting and growing a business on a low cost and low risk basis. So rather than necessarily taking on full time expensive office space, small businesses are keeping the business based at home, but still want to get out of the home office occasionally, meet with their suppliers and partners. And this is why co-working spaces are becoming really popular.
And is that something you think that employers should encourage or discourage? I mean, there's a bit of a tension, isn't there, between whether people are too tired to do their day job or how much energy they put into their day job if they're doing other stuff.
You know, it's really interesting that we just had in Global Entrepreneurship Week the biggest ever Startup Saturday. So it was usually we have 40 people, we form their business. The other day we had 250. So we invited back three former Startup Saturday students. And one of them is an entrepreneur called Philip Crilly, who started a food business, but he's a pharmacist by day. So he's got a great job by day, started this business at night. When he just came to the Startup Saturday event, what he announced to the audience is he's just been promoted in his day job because his company have said, you're picking up so many entrepreneurial skills in your 5-to-9 business,
right,
that
right.
We want to give you the job that you've always wanted because we can see that your skills are developing. So it's, and even when I wrote the Working 5-to-9 book, it profiled 65-to-9ers. I spoke to all of their employers to say, how do you feel about this? Mm. Is this something that you encourage? And most of them did say, we love the fact that they are picking up entrepreneurial skills and the company isn't having to pay for that.
Is that, Bobby, is that your experience of that?
Yeah, I think it's a very good thing. I think there's a lot of people out there at the moment that have some great ideas. They want to develop those ideas and see where they can take them to grow them and develop them and see if it's something that can actually turn into a business. One thing that we always say when someone comes to us with an idea is, you know, you've got to make sure you cover your maximum downside and make sure you have enough income coming in to cover your costs and your day-to-day costs, running your house, your mortgage, your bills. If you've got a family to support, make sure you've got that covered before you jump ship and go and start up a new business that might not work the way you anticipated. So I think it's a very good thing that people are now thinking about second careers and second jobs and starting them up. From the employer's point of view, it can't be a bad thing when it starts out, because I think, as Emma was saying, people are getting entrepreneurial skills, they're developing themselves, they're developing new contacts, new networks, and in areas that might be quite complementary to their business. You know, I recently spoke to one of my clients who, a member of their staff, is thinking of starting up a complementary line of business within their existing company, but using some of the contacts and skills that they've learned from their day job, but having that aligned with what they're doing, and they believe that that's going to generate some work additionally for the new company. But I think where you've got to be very careful is exactly what you said earlier, that people aren't too tired. They're working flat out during the week, and then in the evenings they're working, and by the time they come into work the next morning, they're exhausted from working the night before, and they've got to keep an eye on productivity and make sure that it can be complementary. and not to the detriment of their existing day job.
Because working 5 to 9 sounds great, but it's not 5 to 9.
No, it's a lot later than that. And people have joked and said, why was the book called Working 5 to 9, when in fact what they do is they get home from work at 7, they start the evening job at 8, and then keep on going to the wee hours of the morning.
Yes.
But it's interesting because, again, in the kind of research speaking, still speaking to lots of 5 to 9ers, they say that kind of starting their business energises them, so it gives them kind of more energy in their day job as well. But I think also just this one point to be careful on is, and it made me think when Bobby was saying that somebody was going to do something in a complementary line to their employer, where you do have to be more careful is if you are doing something in direct conflict to the business you're working in. But it's interesting, when you look at lots and lots of 5 to 9ers, their business is actually something that's drastically different to the day job. And so in the 5 to 9 book, I profiled a guy who was a jet pilot by day, and at night he was running a business selling big laces. There was a lady who was an estate agent by day, who was a rare breed pig farmer by night. So they're doing something that's actually quite different to the day job, in which case you're pretty safe in telling your employer.
I think people want to be challenged. They want to learn new skills. I think you're getting, and I don't know what the age profile is from the book of what of people that were doing this type of thing, but I think as people have been working in a career for 15, 20 years, they're starting to get a bit stale. They don't want to leave because they quite enjoy the environment, they enjoy the company they're working in, but they might want to try something a bit different and learn something a bit different, learn a new skill set that gives them the buzz they had 15, 20 years ago when they went into the first industry.
So you must get to a point where your big laces or whatever your other business is has reached such a critical mass that actually it's time to think this isn't a 5 to 9 business, this is a business. How can you tell when you're at that point?
I think the key to that, again, is my first point, which is you've got to know, you've got to take a risk at some point.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you know, you've got to say, well, okay, I'm either going to do it or I'm not. And if you're not going to do it, is it just going to be something that's going to give me a bit of income? Or is it something that I really want to make a go of it? But again, it comes down to, you've always got to make sure that it's going to be of a sufficient scale and be able to generate enough revenue to make sure that you can cover what you need on a daily basis. You know, it's very, very dangerous to jump ship and set up your own thing or take on to grow your own thing if it's not at a sufficient scale or the income's not generating enough to be able to cover what you need to cover on a monthly basis, I think.
Put yourself under a lot of pressure quite quickly.
Yeah, and make wrong decisions potentially.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because I know I just referred to this previous Startup Saturday, the one guy who'd got promoted in his day job. The other girl, who is a girl who runs a blog called Tilly and the Buttons, and she's just been on TV on the Sewing Bee. So she'd been a previous Startup Saturday student. She came and spoke about her experience in going full-time into business. And the way in which that she did it is she first of all went part-time in her job. So essentially she eased her way out of employment into self-employment. And for her, that was because financially she couldn't afford to say, I'll give up the day job completely. So she eased out, she went down to kind of 3 days work, 2 days business, and now she's full-time in the business. And what was a kind of a big responsibility if you're helping people make this decision is there were kind of 250 people in the audience hearing this story of how she did this. And I got a tweet on Monday morning from someone who said, came to Startup Saturday on Saturday, went in today and resigned from my job.
Wow.
To which I said, that is a big move to make, and I wish you all the best. But one of the things we'd said at the event is, I think it is two factors that you think of when you're making the decision. One, financially, can you do it? So have you got enough income coming in? But the second thing, which is slightly more sort of not as scientific, is gut instinct. So in your heart of hearts, do you think, if I don't leave now and go full-time in the business, that it won't take off? So this person clearly decided, financially, I can make it work. Yeah. And my heart is saying to me, right, I have to do this now.
I think sometimes though, people get it wrong. But I think sometimes people look at their business and think this is going to be the best thing ever. If you're doing it as a sideline and you don't need it to be your main source of income and it's generating some income, you think, oh, this is great. Then you jump ship to do it full time. It's a very, very different set of challenges, and you've got to really generate the business and make it grow at a rate of knots. And when you're just doing it as a part-time hobby, if you like, it's very different to making it your full-time career. So you've got to be careful that you can scale it up and it can grow. And it might be that there's a big contract potentially that you're about to win, and that might be the trigger for you to jump. It might be that there's someone that wants to come in as a partner and you're going to grow it together. You know, there's different triggers that might make it the right time for you to do it, but you've got to just identify it and make sure they're the right time.
I mean, surely this gets to the point of having a decent business plan. So it's not... for all, as you say, there's an element of this feels right and this is, you know, in my heart, I know it's the right thing to do, and that instinct and gut is all very important, but it's also quantifiable evidence to say this is the market, I've done the research, this is, you know, cash flow forecast, these are whatever, all that, all those elements that come into a business plan.
I think 9 out of 10 existing businesses don't have a forecast for the coming year or the coming 3 years. And most startups, when they start thinking about a business, they just go into it and say, look, I'm going to go and do this, this is what I want to try. And they don't think they need a business plan. And the number of people that have sat with me and said, well, I can possibly forecast my business, or how can I put a business plan together? I think that's absolutely, that's one of the most dangerous comments you could make, because there's no point going into a business, whether it's a startup, a growing business, if you're looking to expand, merge, any stage of the life cycle of a business, you have to have a business plan that sets out your marketplace, what the strengths and weaknesses of the business are, what the potential opportunities within that marketplace are. Also, have that financial plan that shows what you need, what the hurdles are, how you're going to finance those hurdles, how you're going to develop the business and grow it moving forward. Without that, you're going back to gut instinct. You're making decisions on gut instinct, which sometimes they can be wrong. So you want to be making decisions based on information that you have. It's part gut, but also part informed decisions on action information.
Presumably, at some point, you need to also allow for something a bit more organic, in terms of you need to be prepared to see where things are going and to follow. You know, you can be too rigid in terms of I'm doing big laces. Mm. And if there happens to be a big market for big shoes as well,
well, no,
I've missed the market for big shoes.
Which is interesting, because he's now diversified into sweatbands as well as big laces. So yes, yeah. But it's, and I agree with Bobby on this. I think business plans are essential. We actually call it a route map. So we say that your business plan is your route map, and it's a big point we quite often make to startups and growing businesses, is build flexibility into it. Because a route map will say, I'm here now, this is where I want to get the business. And you will chart the steps to kind of get from here to there, but inevitably there will be left turns and there will be things, hopefully good things, that kind of come out of the way. And in fact, we also say to people, kind of write a plan, but then review it every 6 months or so. So go back and see, am I hitting the targets? Is the business going in the direction I wanted it to? And kind of build in that flexibility. So I agree that's important.
It has to evolve. Yeah, someone that writes a business plan and is still using the same business plan 2 years on, the business isn't evolving, and the plan has to evolve. You know, a forecast is just that, it's a forecast, but there's no point having a forecast or a business plan that becomes a doorstop, because it needs to evolve. You need to review it, you need to look at what the actual results are against the budget and see where you're going, because you might have thought that one area, so your big shoes example, might be one that's delivering loads and loads of revenue, and you might be moving away from the big laces, for example, because the margin on that is much lower. But it's got to evolve. You've got to, the business has to evolve with the plan and what's happening in the marketplace.
And Mr. Big Laces would love the fact we keep on talking about this business. It is actually biglaces.com, if I remember rightly, so he would love this.
So at what point do you bring in your business advisor, your accountant? Should you have them right from the beginning? Is it at the point where you think, actually, this is a full-time business? When would you suggest?
Well, I'm going to say right from the beginning. I was going to let Emma answer that one. But I think it's very important from the beginning that if you identify what skills you have and you identify what you're good at. And, you know, I'm meeting lots of startup businesses at the moment who are saying to me, you know, I'm great at cutting hair. I'm great at selling food. I'm a good chef. I'm a good consultant. And I reckon they recognise that that's what they're good at. And they're saying, look, I have skills gaps in my team. And we need you to come in and help us to develop and deliver the skills that we don't have. Mm-hmm. So I think it's very important when you're writing that business plan at the early stages to identify what you're good at and what you can do. Where you aren't comfortable with doing certain areas, bring in experts or professionals or advisors who can come in. It might be you need someone to help you on your property strategy to get that right. It might be a lawyer to make sure your contracts are correct with your customers. But also an accountant is absolutely key because they can make sure you're setting up in the right structure. Because people will go off and set up on their own as a self-employed person when they actually should be in a limited company structure or an LLP. So there's structural issues, there's the VAT implications of setting up, you know, what we think the turnover is going to be and when to register for VAT. Do I set up a payroll scheme if I'm going to employ people? Mm. If the business plan is pointing to those areas, you should take advice so you don't get it wrong, because it could be a very costly error.
And I totally agree with that. And in fact, for all the reasons that Bobby has just said, is with so many things when it comes to accounting, we offer advice from Enterprise Nation, where we say focus on what you do best and outsource the rest. And we say this relentlessly, and it is exactly that point, that at the early stages of the business, what you're not good at, unless you're a qualified accountant, is doing the accounting. So I know that there's some fantastic support on offer from accountants through the Business Advice Service at the Institute of Chartered Accountants of England and Wales, where you can get a free 1 hour consultation with an accountant. And I think we're seeing lots of small businesses take that up because they know that they shouldn't be doing it.
And actually, Clive Lewis, who's the head of the BAS service at ICAW, has written us a piece around, I think it's 10 of the top things that you should think about with regards to tax and company structure and those very practical things that perhaps a lot of entrepreneurs have a great vision, but they don't necessarily stop to think about those very practical points.
Clive also writes really good things, actually, about how to choose the right accountant. So he talks about kind of finding a firm that's almost maybe the same size as you, because then they'll understand what it's like to run a business. Getting cost quotes, I guess, is a basic thing. And do you like the people? So I love the fact that as head of enterprise and head of the business advice service, that he actually suggests that you go to 3 accountants. So kind of make the most of the free consultations with more than one accountant, just to kind of shop around, see who you like. So it's, but there's enough business to go around.
I think it very much depends on the experience of the person setting up the business, because historically people just view accountants as bean counters and number crunchers that will come in a few months after the year end and do a set of accounts and can't really add value. But the firms of today are vastly different to where they were years ago, and they're now looking at what they've got, the ability, and they've got people within the practices who have commercial experience who can help plug the skills gaps. So if you're setting up a business and there's, you know, huge working capital issues, for example, and you don't know how to fund your working capital cycle, you could go to an accountant now who will be able to help you with that. They understand invoice discounting, they understand factoring and trade finance and how to help you get your export business up and running. So you've got a new breed of accountant within the profession who is able to give advice on a very broad skill set, as opposed to just being able to do your statutory and compliance needs.
Entrepreneurial accountants, I think they call them.
more kind of strategic stuff rather than just the technical
detailed
stuff.
Mm. It's, you know, we've got some fantastic case studies where we've worked with businesses who have come to us and said just that, you know, I know how to do one thing, and we've helped them write their business plans, we've helped put the forecast together, and we've pointed them in the right direction and become almost the air traffic controller and said, look, you know what, we need to bring in this person here to develop the property strategy, and we need this person to help, you know, with your legal matters. So it's very important that you identify what your skill set is and where those gaps are, and then use professional advisors who have maybe a broader network that can bring in those people.
So we're at the stage of a business where you've grown, you're into it full time, it's what you're doing, the business is hopefully going in the right direction. I guess the traditional route would then be, let's take on staff, let's take on property, let's find an office space and let's move into it and grow a big business in that big office space and take on a lot of overheads and all that sort of stuff. The very fact that we're here at this pop-up, this kind of shared co-working workspace, shows that things have changed quite a lot.
They have changed, and I really welcome this change, and it's a big thing we talked to government about, actually, and it was the word that you used, is the traditional form of growing is to take on overheads and to associate growth with hiring people. Yeah. But actually what we are seeing across the Enterprise Nation and the wider small business base is that the way small businesses are growing is by outsourcing and subcontracting work as opposed to hiring individuals. And they're finding fantastic talent, and bearing in mind that a lot of talent now is available on a self-employed basis. So lots of really talented people have chosen themselves to go self-employed. They're on marketplaces like Elance and Odesk.com, so it's easy to find them. And then, as you say, there's co-working spaces like this where you can come and meet with them. So as the business owner, you're not taking on the cost, you're staying really flexible, you don't have to manage and motivate people, so you can just move at pace and hopefully grow the business in the right direction on a low risk and low cost basis.
I think the key is the word Emma used there, which is flexibility. You know, whether you're an established business or a growing business, the recession has been very good in some respects, because it's made people look at their costs, look at every line of their cost base, whether it be, you know, the direct cost of inputs or their overheads. And people are reviewing that and saying, actually, you know, how can I build some flexibility into my business? So the growth of the pop-up shop, flexibility within their employee workforce as well, and looking at pay structures and commission and basic salaries, but more importantly, looking at freelancers and flexible working. So I think it's very important that as a business grows, you factor in flexibility and make sure that you can keep your overheads. And you know, it's, we talk with lots of businesses and people who aren't financially experienced, and explain to them, you know, what is the cost, your fixed overhead, what is the cost of opening your doors? When you open that door in the morning, what do you have to pay before you sell one thing? and trying to get that amount as low as possible. That is something that we're working with lots of businesses on. And key is flexibility and keeping your fixed costs as low as possible.
There's a downside to that flexibility in that, in terms of employment, is the 0 hours contracts and that sort of stuff. You know, there's lots of people, unfortunately, who are in more flexible employment than they would like.
Well, I would kind of agree to disagree on that. And in fact, if anything, I think employment systems need to change to come up to date with how businesses are employing people. For instance, one particular thing that we're pushing for at the moment is, if you are a company that's growing through freelance employees or freelance subcontractors, you cannot give shares, you can't easily give shares in your company to those freelancers. If you have them as employees, there are lots of employee share ownership schemes.
Yes.
What's not so apparent is how you give that to freelancers, which is crazy, because what these business owners are building is teams of people that still have a very common, united kind of vision on what they want that business to achieve. It just so happens that they're not employees of that company. So you have business owners who want to reward freelancers and subcontractors in the same way as if they were employees, but actually employment rules and regulations in the UK just haven't caught up with how businesses are looking to hire.
Is that how you find that most people do start off taking on staff, freelancers and flexible working?
I think I'll go one step further to what Emma's saying there, because I think the key is businesses at the moment are now looking at how they can build their business and how they can grow it. And you know, if it's a business that relies on staff, that's one thing. And in order to achieve that, what they're looking at is the ability to motivate staff. And what's always going to happen, whether it's a freelancer or whether it's a full-time employee, if someone is good and valuable in a business that's going to help you grow it, then a business will not want to let that person go. If they want to work on a freelance contract and be self-employed, and they are genuinely self-employed, then that's one thing. But a company will identify that and say, actually, this person's pretty integral to the business. Then they'll bring them into the company, share options with on the EMI schemes and all sorts of things. So I think businesses will always incentivise key staff, but having the ability to be flexible and use freelancers at the beginning will allow you to identify those people as the business is growing, rather than have to employ them, and then if they don't work out, then you've got to get rid of them.
Try before you buy.
Yeah, well, basically,
sort of temp to perm type stuff.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It must be very emotive to give away part of your business, or not necessarily to give away, but to let someone else have control over part of the business you've been growing up to that point.
I think, again, it comes down to forward-thinking entrepreneurs and people that are very in control and understand where their business is going, because I think the days are gone where you can, you know, say the shares are mine, I'm not giving you anything, you're not having any ownership. It doesn't work like that anymore, because people are much more fluid in their views on employment now. You know, job for life, staying somewhere for 30, 40 years, I don't really see that as a current trend. I think people are now moving around a lot more than ever, and certainly young people going into some of the creative industries are going to one agency, for example. When they get to the level they wanted, they go to another agency because they can get a bigger pay rise and jump across. So I think that the workforce is fluid, but I think they do need to incentivise the key members of staff and use shares or ownership to actually incentivise people and help them grow. So I think we are seeing it a lot more now.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sharing of the risk, isn't it, in a sense? Because it's, as a freelancer, if you're doing work for somebody and they say, we can't afford to pay you, but we'll give you 5% of the company, and in the future it's going to be worth millions.
Well,
you know, you're kind of buying into
a vision
there, and it doesn't necessarily motivate you after a few months when you realise actually you're not getting paid anything and you're doing a lot of work for not.
Absolutely. And I'm not necessarily maybe if I use my company as an example, because this is why we're pushing the government, is and going back to Helen's question, is business owners, I do think, are still a little bit reluctant to give over shares and equity in their company, and understandably so, because when it's your business, you want the right people to get a share ownership in it. So as a business, we have waited 8 years before we've kind of opened up the idea of share ownership to the people who contribute to the success of the company. They all still continue to get paid, so this would be an addition to their payment. But quite a few of them are freelancers, and that's why I just think it's crazy that they cannot get share ownership in a similar way to the people who are employees. Mm. But it's really...
They can get it, but not as tax efficiently.
Well, not as tax efficiently, and also there is just not... If you look at the employee share ownership scheme that exists in the UK, and I have been and spoken to lots of people now, the cooperative movement, the employee share ownership people in government, I've spoken to the man who has developed new models around this, and the systems are there, but what they don't do is they don't promote it as a solution to say this is how you can give shares to freelancers. It's still very much an employee share ownership scheme, which, as I say, I think is fine for companies that have employees, but there are so many more businesses now that don't, that all I said to him is, I think what you've got is the right model. You just need to package it up and promote it for the fact that it's for a small business with freelancers, and I think you get lots more uptake.
I think it depends on the business as well and the people that are involved in it, because I've got two businesses in very similar positions at the moment where there was the entrepreneur that started the business is now in mid-60s, and they've got a younger partner in the business now who's early 30s. And in one instance, the more senior partner is saying, that's great, you can have the business, it's yours, you know, let's work out how we get the ownership to you, and you know, we can see what my exit is. And the other one's saying, no, I want to keep my shares, you're not getting anything. So I've got two identical situations, similar ages, and it very much depends on the view of the owners, the people in the business, mm-hmm. and what they want to do with the business and what their strategy is. But there are ways, under the MI scheme, for example, if you're sort of giving key employees options in the business, it does protect the company in some way, that if it doesn't work out over a period of time and they leave, then the options lapse and they don't actually get them. So there are ways of dealing with the issues that could stop the owners of the business passing over shares. But I think it's a massive incentive for people to actually say, look, if I help build this business, I could potentially own some of it. And if it sells, I'm going to get my share of the sale.
Are there any rules about when it's the right time to say, like, freelancing's great, and I've grown this far without having to take on any people, but you know, it feels now that I need a bit of space, or I need a few people who are here all the time who I can definitely draw on. When should you take on staff?
I think it comes back to the flexibility and the business plan and the forecast, and you've got to look at, you know, what's the cost of opening my doors. So if I know that my break-even point is X, and you know, if I can, with the guaranteed income I've got, cover my overheads, that's one thing. And it might be that you need certain people full time within the business that are going to help and be there and help you grow it. So I think it's very much all about you'll know when the right time is, because you'll know the people, and you'll know if you don't want to lose them, and you know, if you don't want them to go and do freelance contracts elsewhere. But also it comes down to being in control of your business, and you're in control of it, as opposed to the business, you know, the other way around. Yeah. So I think people need to genuinely understand when it's the right time.
And I hate to say, I don't think you'll ever get me to say that when is a good time to hire people full time. I'm just such a huge believer, because I think if you hire freelancers and subcontractors, and I think even maybe some of that terminology may have to change, because I think people would assume that freelancers aren't very loyal to a company. They kind of go from one gig to the next, when in fact that's not the case. So the kind of Enterprise Nation team is made up of 8 or 9 freelancers who are very loyal and understand the Enterprise Nation brand and what we're trying to achieve. So I guess in my view, I think you get the best people. They're all self-motivated because they are self-employed, so they motivate themselves, and they are also at the same time very loyal to the company. So I have to admit, I just don't encourage anyone to hire people full time. I say go out and get the best talent that's available on a freelance basis.
I think it depends on the sector as well, though, because in creative industries, freelancers are key, because you might have a project that's, if you're in a marketing agency, for example, you might have a brand development project, so you need a brand development freelancer, and the next time it's a digital project, so you know, it's a different skill set. In a professional practice, for example, where you know, we're training chartered accountants,
you need
full-time people, because you're spending huge amounts on training and development. The last thing you want is to spend tens of thousands of pounds training someone for them to go and then be a freelancer.
But actually,
else,
wouldn't that be an interesting idea? That if the individual pays for themselves, which is also why I like freelancers, because they pay for their own training budget, and yet they use you as kind of an umbrella of business development and kind of working together, pulling in new projects. So again, I just wonder if that could be a new model for accounting. And interestingly, in the legal profession, there's a really interesting company called Keystone Law, which has started, which rather than one expensive offices in the city, they have people who are lawyers who've been steeped in experience in the city and fantastic lawyers who've had years of experience and then want the flexibility of working from home. And all these lawyers are still part of the Keystone Law network, so they do the legal contracts, they service fantastic clients, but they're all self-employed individuals. So I think in some of the professional service industries, that's starting to change.
IFAs have been doing that, where they have an umbrella organisation where people are self-employed and have their own practices, but they work under a banner.
A brand.
Well, to train a chartered student, for example, through the exams, it costs a lot of money. Yeah. There's a lot of input that goes into it. And if you're thinking that, you know, you've got a student that's just come out at 21 years old, they might, unless they've got a rich family or people funded, they're not going to have the funds.
Get a start on loan.
And then you start getting the student loan, you're back into student loans situation where people are going to have to borrow the money through their own training, and it might come back. And if, you know, so I think it very much, you can use freelance, but I think it very much depends on the sector, and sometimes it's not appropriate, but
I think that's a fair point.
Okay, well, you've got your startup, you've got your business, you've sorted out your staff. I guess one of the other key areas is, when do you think about moving into new markets? When do you look at exporting? Or are we in such a globalised world now that it's there right from day one?
No, I think it's, and it, again, it's something we talk about a lot. We've got a Go Global event here next week. So there's 1.2 billion customers online at the moment, and only 60 million of them in the UK. So we are seeing businesses go global quicker than ever before. And they are enabled by, and we hear about these websites a lot, eBay, Elance, Etsy.com, Alibaba.com, which is a huge route into China. These big websites have been fantastic. Etsy.com, for instance, which is a website where if you make handmade goods, you upload it to their website. They have got 133,000 people from the UK who are trading on Etsy.com, so these 133,000 businesses. And I've spoken to lots of Etsy sellers where almost their first sales are outside of the UK.
Right.
So they go global within almost a week of setting up their business. So we're seeing this happen at kind of great speed. The government help companies do this, so they've got this agency called UK Trade and Investment, which is there to encourage and support. And you can see politically there's a big move to encourage smaller businesses. So the Prime Minister next month is going on a trip to China and taking the biggest ever small business mission with him to say, right, come on, small businesses, you can access what is a huge market. And interestingly, and just a final point on that, if you look at a market like China, it has billions of consumers, increasingly middle-class consumers, and there's such a big appetite at the moment for British-made and designed products. So companies such as Cambridge Satchel Company are doing incredibly well in international territories because people want to buy something with British provenance. So businesses are going global really quickly, and I think it's great.
I think also the new entrepreneurs that are coming into business today, they're setting up their own businesses, were born into a world that doesn't have borders. And they grew up with the internet, they understand about Skype, they understand how to talk to people, have global conferences to understand, to talk to people around the world in a much easier and more straightforward way, so they're used to it. People that are have been in business 20, 30 years might not, haven't grown up around that, don't understand that. So I think a lot of the businesses that are starting up today don't see it as a barrier. And see it as just, you know, that's the way business is now.
But there are pitfalls, aren't there? I mean, it's all very nice to say it's easy and there's a whole global world there, and you just put up your website and you send your products to China, and it's really easy to do business with China, and they really want your products, etc., etc. The realities are there are quite a lot of complexities that there can be, and it can be quite a difficult thing to do.
Well, again, this is interesting, and I'm sorry to keep on referring and plugging books that we've written, but in 2010 I wrote a book called Go Global, How to Take Your Business to the World. And so a lot of the intelligence I get is from businesses who have been there and done it. So in that book I profiled 30 exporters, and what was really interesting from them is that they said they almost got into exporting accidentally. And I spoke about this at the beginning of the book. There is a perception that exporting is really difficult, that you have to be a big business with big budgets, because what do you do if you don't get paid? What do you do when you're dealing in a country with new languages and new cultures? But of all the businesses that were successfully exporting, it was that they got an order and thought, well, I've got to service this, or they got covered. One of them got covered on an American blog, and the next thing she knew, she'd got a deal from Anthropology, which is this huge US department store. And because they accidentally fell into it, realised it wasn't as difficult as they thought. And the reason why it's not as difficult is, one of them, for instance, I said, how did you learn about the export documentation that you need to complete? And she said, I learnt it from the UPS man. She learnt it from the delivery man. Payment is PayPal, I have to say, is very good because it's just accepted in all places now. Google Translate, which is a free service you can use before you've got budget to kind of do anything. Going back to UK Trade and Investment, they do a great programme called Trade Show Access Programme, where you can visit places and they'll kind of pay for that for you. So actually, I think going global is becoming much more straightforward because these technology platforms help you, and there's a big kind of support system there to say there will be challenges. So if you're trying to get manufacturing done in Asia, do you have to go? Not always. And there will be hiccups. But every small business owner I know who's gone through it carries on with it and comes out of it a much stronger person, having had that experience. So I think for anyone who's considering export, I would say just give it a go. Research which markets you think you could be in. and I talk about this in the Go Global book, of 5 steps to going global. Start promoting yourself, make sales over there using these technology platforms, and only once you're making sales, then maybe think about going local into that market and investing a little bit more.
That's what I was going to say. I think it very much depends, and it goes back to taking professional advice and looking at what you want to do. Do you stay in the UK and export and run it from the UK, or should you be setting up a branch or subsidiary or another company out there? Now, I've been working with one company that's been selling their products in the UK and launched in the US in Vegas in August of this year. But they took the route where they've now got a local presence there, and they've got someone running that office, because the complexities in the US, you know, we've seen lots of businesses in the past that have failed, that have tried to go into the US, and they've got a lady there who really understands the US market and is fronting that business and is driving that forward. So they took that route. Another business I'm working with is now exporting to China, but they're running it from the UK with the UK office. So I think you've got to take some advice early on and give some real thought to the best way of doing it. Can you control it from the UK? Is that possible, or do you need a local presence? And if you do, what is the best way of doing it, and understand the tax rules and the employment laws, and can you just have a room, put your name of your company above the door and kick off and say you've got a presence and you're allowed to do that legally in the territory, or do you have to have a proper presence with local management and all sorts of infrastructure? So I think it's just worth taking advice early on.
There's a role for partnering, presumably. I mean, that's an obvious way to grow.
Absolutely. And this is what these websites enable you to do. And just on the office side of things, so not to mention too many brands, but Regus, which is a business I love, set up by a British entrepreneur, have got offices all over the world that enables you to get a virtual office presence. So if you want to, say, do business in the US, but you don't want to spend your budget, you just get a virtual office presence and at least kind of start from there. Yes. So partnering either with other businesses or actually just partnering with big brands who are there to help you access new markets.
Do you see many people come to you and say, look, we've moved into this market, we've got into a right mess, we didn't realise we've contravened all sorts of laws and tax?
What I see is people that get overexcited, get a bit carried away with themselves and think, right, I'm now going to go and sell in every territory in the world and I'm going to sell it everywhere, and they don't have the infrastructure to do it. And I think it's very important that you expand in a carefully controlled and managed way that is planned and thought through, rather than just saying, right, I've got an order, I'm now going to take on the world. Yeah. Because if you have chaos to begin with and you start bringing in new orders, you're just only going to add to that chaos. The key is to make sure that you've got the right infrastructure, the right processes, the right structures in place, and you can get the right information out, so that as you do expand, it's in a carefully controlled and thought out way.
I think that might be the place to leave it, and careful, controlled business expansion.
That's the accountant talking.
We've got a lot more on these topics at icaw.com/economia, where we did lots of coverage during Global Entrepreneurship Week.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks very much to Emma, Bobby and Helen. And if you want to find out more, you can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/economiamag and follow us on Twitter